Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hi everybody, welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a film critic and writer. And today I'm going to be talking to George Stevens Jr. George is a legendary figure in Hollywood. He has straddled the world of Hollywood and politics, I would say. He's a writer, director, playwright, and now he's written his memoir, My Place in the Sun. Among his many achievements is the founding of the AFI, the American Film Institute, which launched the careers of such names as David Lynch, Terrence Malick, and Paul Schrader, amongst many others. If you enjoy the podcast, please remember to like, subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, if that's how you're listening to it, or Spotify, if you can rate it for us, that would be wonderful. The numbers are going up. The numbers are going up in a way which is extremely gratifying. But the reason is it isn't ego. I don't want the numbers to go up just because it pleases my sordid soul. It's also because these conversations, because of the guests, I just want people to know that they're out there as a resource, just because of the guests, just absolutely, you know, these are fascinating people, and the more people that hear them, the better. You can follow me, if you really want, and this is my sordid soul, at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty, but before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
I just want to say I feel in very good company. Your interviews are very interesting, and happy to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, in fact, when I was reading your book, I was kind of thinking, oh my God, how do I talk to the man who has talked to all the presidents from Kennedy to Obama, you know, all the way through? How could I possibly, think of questions interesting enough to put to you?
Well, that, yes, I guess there are a couple of exceptions there. I guess only Jerry Ford I never spoke with, but and Nixon very briefly. Simply. But I've had my life has been an interesting opportunity. I've been in two different worlds that have that interlock in certain ways, and with and as I wrote the book, I just realized how fortunate I'd been to be in the company of significant people, and most of them intelligent and humanistic.
The book reads like almost like a wonderful novel that you just have. There's so many, such a epic life in many ways. I mean, starting with your childhood, and of course your father. It must have been quite a joy to have the opportunity to go back and revisit that part of your life.
It's very comforting to kind of do a kind of review and summing up, and you discover things and you remember certain memories become more important and significant.
And of course, you also had the opportunity to sort of go back and have a look at your sort of grandparents and that legacy. Yeah. Was that stuff you already knew, or was that some of that did you sort of discover in the process of writing?
I knew the broad strokes, but we never talked a great deal about it. No, I'd met my grandparents, and they were just my grandparents, and I kind of knew they had a theatrical background, and never really explored it. My mother kept from my father's mother all of these papers from the family, which, you know, clippings and, you know, the opening paragraph of the film. My grandfather at age 24 walking out of his theater in Oakland to go back to San Francisco for the night and gets mugged and I'm reading the story from the San Francisco, whatever the paper was, San Francisco Call, I believe. So that was very helpful.
The fact as well that you are from this sort of family of sort of show business, of actors, mm-hmm. But I mean, obviously the most famous that we sort of know of the group is going to be your father.
Yes.
And his the relationship that you portray is really moving. It's a really beautiful relationship.
Yeah, I was blessed, you know, but also with a wonderful mother. But to have a quote famous or accomplished father, which can, you know, for many people in Hollywood, you know, there are the stories of children of prominent directors and stars having difficult lives, and I had a wonderful relationship with my father.
How do you think you avoided that? How do you think, you know, your family managed to remain to some degree grounded?
I think it was just their quality. And my father was just not the kind of prototype of the domineering director, but he was just a wonderful, gentle father that also, you know, the strongest of directors on the set. You know, but with it just a kind of a different style. And we developed common interests. And this was also considering the fact that he was away at war for 3 years. But he kept all the letters we sent him, and my mother kept the letters he sent. And they're all in the Motion Picture Academy. And to be able to look back on these exchanges was, again, eye-opening to me.
Was there anything specific that you learned in looking back over them that popped out?
Just the kind of having become a father myself, kind of fatherly wisdom, you know, his attitude toward me, his sense of fun, an occasional stimulation to improve, but always with a deft touch.
And when did you sort of start to sort of become conscious of his profession and the sort of world he moved in?
Well, I knew he was a movie. I was embarrassed in the fifth or sixth grade when I was starting school, and everyone was asked what your father does, and I said, well, my father's a director, and the teacher said, what do you mean? And I didn't know what I meant. that was what I was told he did. And then as I became a teenager, I became more conscious of it and spent some occasional time on the studio, at the studio with him. And then in my later teens, I became very involved with him.
Yeah, I mean, that sense of what Orson Welles called, you know, the biggest train set a boy can have. Yeah, that, you must have sort of had a feeling for that, because you were there as a boy.
I probably took it more for granted than Orson, because Orson came in at 24 and it was his to play with. But and I was not at all kind of certain I was going to go in the direction of my father's career. As I say in the book, the year I graduated from high school, I didn't have a summer job. And Dad said, well, why don't you work with me? And he gave me two assignments. One was to break down Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy, parts 1 and 2, this classic novel, and put it in notebooks, every character, every scene, because he was about to start work on A Place in the Sun based on Dreiser's American Tragedy. And the other was to read the books that came over from Paramount and the scripts. And, you know, there were a lot of kind of treacly love story, you know, the novel of the summer that were not, you know, fascinating to a 17-year-old on hot summer days. But one day, a small book came and I read it in the afternoon. And I went to see my father that night and he was in bed. He was reading. And I walked in with this book and I said, Dad, this is really a good story. I said, I think you ought to read it. And he said, why don't you tell me the story? So I found myself walking around his bed trying to reconstruct what I remembered of the story of Shane, Jack Schaefer's novel, and make the story interesting to him. Well, of course, Shane became my next summer's job working on the location. But, you know, as I remembered that incident in my life, but when I started to write about it, I realized that he was just giving me an opportunity to find, out whether I had any aptitude or interest for his world. And, you know, it was a very interesting, thoughtful way to do it. And he never encouraged me. I was bound to be a sports writer and he thought that was great. But gradually I came into the family profession.
Family business, yeah. But I mean, wow, that investment paid off. You know, getting you to do the to pick a book, you couldn't have done better.
I got to tell you another story that I became more important to me as I look back on it. I always remembered having gone to the Academy Awards. I think it was 1951 with my father, and he was nominated for A Place in the Sun. Hmm. And I remember my mother and his actress mother were with us. He was driving the car. They were in the back seat. And I sat next to him during the awards. And Joseph L. Mankiewicz, head of the Directors Guild, and came out and read the nominations for Best Director. It was John Huston, African Queen, William Wyler, The Desperate Hours, Vincent Minnelli, An American in Paris, Elia Kazan, A Streetcar Named Desire, and George Stevens, A Place in the Sun. And Mankiewicz, a good year, no?
So I was going to say that's a strong year, isn't it?
And Mankiewicz read the envelope and read it, and George Stevens, A Place in the Sun. We were driving home, and the Oscar was on the seat. I was in the front seat with my father, and the Oscar was on the seat between us. And for whatever reason, he looked over at me, and he said, you know, he said, we'll have a better idea what kind of a film this is in about 25 years. that he had a sense of perspective, and he also had this feeling of the test of time. He knew what mattered. He was not so keen on making the most fashionable film of the year. He wanted to make, you know, something that he thought had lasting value. Now, of course, I must have been 17 or 18. He did not realize he was talking to the future founder of the American Film Institute. But he was giving me an idea that became so much the core of the American Film Institute's nature, you know, the test of time, that what mattered were the films that last, and it was important to preserve them and to respect and recognize the people who made the films that stood the test of time.
And to underline another aspect of that early part of your book is you have a sort of it kind of runs like a thread through the book, a fascination with Miss Elizabeth Taylor. that he's, again, pretty enviable for a teenager to be.
Yes, I mean, when I was at Occidental College, not a terribly well-known liberal arts college until it became known that Barack Obama went there much later than I. And I went over to visit the set of A Place in the Sun, and Dad was there working with Monty Clift and Elizabeth Taylor. And I watched them do a scene, and he introduced me to Elizabeth, and we were the same age. I think she was 17, just about to be 18. And a little later, she comes over and says, "Do you want to go for lunch?" And the next thing I know, I'm walking through the studio streets with Elizabeth, and into the dining room, in her wake, and to sit down and have. I do remember it was hamburgers and chocolate milkshakes.
I was definitely going to ask what you ate as well.
And little again did I know that a friendship that would last through the years was started with those milkshakes.
Yes, absolutely. My God, that must have been. You know, I'm surprised you managed to eat. I would have been so nervous. But I guess you were just used to having people around the house. You were used to people in the, you know, going to parties and having, you know, parties in the house.
Not so much. I mean, we lived in Toluca Lake, not in right. Beverly Hills. And, you know, I was conscious of my father's work, but they didn't bring it home that much. Yet I did, you know, did meet prominent people, and prominent people lived in our neighborhood. A family named Crosby lived down the street, Bing and his five sons. But there were also very normal people in our neighborhood.
So that, in a way, gives you a good preparation for sort of being in that world, because it just means you're not as awed as, well, as I say, right. Someone like me would be.
Yes, someone asked me in an interview that I'm doing for my book, Leonard Maltin, whom you know or have heard, and his daughter does his interviews with him now. And she asked me, well, what was the first star that really gave you that feeling of, you know, and excitement? And I stopped and I thought, and I couldn't think of one, you know, because I was impressed with them or interested to meet them, but it was not that. And I saw she was disappointed. And then a couple of minutes later, I came back and I said, I realized who it was where I had that feeling. And she said, who? And when I first met him, and I said, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Meeting him was the way she felt about meeting movie stars. You know, when I got to Washington, and within 2 weeks, I had this situation. I was invited to a party at R. Sergeant Shriver. Sergeant Shriver founded the Peace Corps for President Kennedy. He was married to President Kennedy's sister, Eunice. And I was invited to this black tie party. I was 29 years old, new in Washington. And it was all of, you know, the fascinating people in Washington. And right. After dinner, they passed around cocktails on trays. And I, yeah. And after dinner, the waiters in those days, they passed around trays with drinks. And I had an after dinner scotch and soda. And they had the Shrivers had a round entryway to their house, and people were gathered there. And I looked over, and the front door seemed to blow open. And through the door walked, and it's winter, and through the door walked John Kennedy with no coat and black tie, followed by Lyndon Johnson. They'd been at a dinner for the Prince of Saudi Arabia or something. And you know, there was the first time I'd seen a president in person. And he walked through this room, this circular room, and I was sort of in the back of two rows or circles. And he walked around, and just to see him, to be 4 feet from him, it was so impressive in that it was a black and white era, and here was this man in color. And so strangely, that was my sort of moment, not meeting a movie star, but meeting somebody of political significance that had this lasting memory for me.
You start to then move between the worlds of, like, you have one foot in the political camp and one foot in Hollywood, and you sort of combine those two roles.
Yes. Yes.
How was that transition for you?
Well, it was a kind of a dramatic transition in retrospect, that I had now been directing Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Peter Gunn and television series, and I was just about to turn 30, and worked with my father, and I'd become his associate producer and directed all the location scenes for The Diary of Anne Frank, and I was pretty much going in that direction. So to make the decision to give that up and go to Washington was a big decision. I would, you know, it was the unknown, but it was perhaps the most interesting decision I made in my life, to take on the unknown. And it turned out to be the most exciting time to be in government, everyone said. I mean, the new frontier. And Edward R. Murrow, the famed broadcaster, had gone to Washington to head USIA. So I was working for this remarkable man and for President Kennedy. And I enjoyed the opportunity to serve the country at USIA. We were making films to tell America's story abroad. And I met a whole new cadre of interesting and fascinating and purposeful people.
Was there ever a moment where you sort of thought about what might have been in terms of, I know you came back later to direct films as well, but was there ever a moment where you thought, oh, I could have sort of had a career as a director?
I was conscious of it, but I just thought that I would not want to give up what I had discovered in this, you know, world of public service and public life. And I had not, because I soon started the American Film Institute 5 years later, and that re-engaged me with Hollywood.
What was the genesis of the American Film Institute, if you could describe that a little bit?
Yes, the United States never had funding for the arts. President Kennedy spoke of the need for that, the greatest artist. My father was on it as well. And they knew what to do about painting and poetry and dance, but they didn't know what to do about film. And they turned to me because I was in the government. I had this experience. I was working with young filmmakers, making these 300 documentaries a year. And so I suggested an American Film Institute, and it evolved, and they decided to make it happen, and they asked me to run it.
That must have been a huge challenge, but at the same time, so exciting.
Well, that's at a time where I really weighed whether I should go back, you know, because I was going into the very much the unknown, and it was a huge challenge, and it was it turned out to be more challenging than I anticipated, because soon thereafter, Nixon was elected and decided to go a different direction in the arts. And we had to really struggle to get the funding we needed, but we did and made it work. And, you know, it's an institution now that's lived for 50 years. The conservatory that we started in the first 3 years, or the first year, it included Terrence Malick, Paul Schrader, Caleb Deschanel, Tom Rickman. The next year, David Lynch. And it really became a bridge between learning filmmaking and the profession, and it prospers to this day. And really, today it's half of its participants are female, many from abroad. It's an institution we're very proud of.
That those first years as well, when you were just finding your feet. I mean, I've been involved in education, and it's often like those first years, you kind of think, okay, we're not going to really achieve anything because we won't work out what we're doing for a few years. But you had so many, you know, amazing people.
Well, you know, we made a choice that because there were film schools, NYU, Columbia, UCLA, USC, where people had gotten some familiarity with the tools of the trade. But we decided that our choice in selecting, which were only 18 people in that first year, that we were not interested in what they knew about the mechanics of filmmaking, but what kind of people they are and what kind of stories they might have to tell. And so I think we made some very good choices that set us off on a promising path.
How hands-on were you in those early years then? Were you sort of, you were interviewing people to recruit them and to give them fellowships, and you were running the day-to-day business of the conservatory as well as the AFI?
Yeah, I moved with my young children and wife to Los Angeles for 2 years to get the, we called it the Center for Advanced Film Studies, then changed its name to the AFI Conservatory, but to get that started.
And what were your impressions of people like Schrader, Malik, Lynch, when you first met them? There must have been a fairly mixed bag of sort of young men.
Yes, indeed. I mean, Terry Malik became a great friend, and I later produced The Thin Red Line with him. And Paul Schrader was very antagonistic. He was, you know, fascinated with Japanese cinema, rebellious, and those are not bad qualities. And David Lynch was this charming kid from Philadelphia, just bright, open, and you had no idea that the complicated ideas that would come through in his films existed in this happy and very personable young man.
Was there a sort of collegiate atmosphere? Were they sort of, you know, did they mix at all, or were they?
Yes,
sort of doing
they were all together. We were given this mansion called Greystone in Beverly Hills, and everybody came there every day. David Lynch lived in the stables of this mansion for 2 years, producing Eraserhead.
And that's just that alone. If nothing else had happened, that alone would have been a contribution to American cinema.
Yes. And Mel Brooks saw Eraserhead, which for your readers is a very, how would you describe it? It's
surreal, nightmarish.
Exactly. And Mel Brooks saw it. And God, this guy must have talent. And he was making The Elephant Man and wanted to meet David Lynch for a director. So he was waiting for this weird guy who made.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
this surrealistic film. And he says, and in walks Charles Lindbergh in a leather jacket.
His normality is another form of subversion, perhaps.
I think so. Wonderful man, David Lynch.
Absolutely. And then you go on with the AFI to honor, and to start sort of promoting the idea of a legacy of American film. And your first sort of honoree ends up not being the, because you want Cary Grant, but he doesn't do television.
Well, yes, but the Cary Grant idea was simply when I was desperate because in the Nixon era, our funding had been cut off, and I was offered by the government or the National Endowment for the Arts a $500,000 matching grant. And I was already raising all the money I could find. So where am I? And matching grant, Cary Grant. So I got an idea of doing an event honoring Cary Grant at the Kennedy Center just to, you know, to raise money. Later, about 3 years later, I had developed the idea of the AFI Life Achievement Award, which would be given not for the popular film of this year, but for an individual whose work has stood the test of time. And our first honoree was John Ford. And again, it was the idea to really respect creators of film for their lifetime achievement. And it continues to this day. But I wrote and produced the first 25 of them. And, you know, we just had the riches of, you know, and it was John Ford, James Cagney, Cary Grant, Orson Welles, then, you know, Betty Davis, William Wyler, John Huston, Lillian Gish, Jimmy Stewart, Capra. You know, it was a candy store, you know, of great people to honor. And they were at late stages of their career, which kind of gave extra resonance to the honoring of them. And Sidney Poitier was a memorable occasion in that respect.
I mean, I was talking earlier about saying, oh, how can I talk to the man who's talked to all the presidents? But when I think of the Hollywood royalty that you have, you've known intimately, or you've known on this basis, Orson Welles, for instance, is one of my all-time heroes. Yeah. I mean, what was he like in, I mean, I was going to say, what was he like in real life? But was there a real life with Orson Welles?
Yes, indeed. And Orson was also magisterial in real life. And I used to see him at Ma Maison, a restaurant in Hollywood, where he would had his own table and say hello from time to time. But then we honored him. And he always, he remembered my father. My father was not that much, maybe 5 years, 10 years older than Orson. But when Orson came to RKO to find that electric train set that every boy wanted, he said to me, he said, your father had become a important director then. And he was very generous to me. And we did the Life Achievement Award. And when I was making the film that I wrote and directed called George Stevens, A Filmmaker's Journey, a feature length film about my father, shortly after he died, I got a phone call, and it was the unmistakable voice of Orson. And he reminded me of how nice my father had been to him in those days. And he said, if you need any help, if you need a narrator, I'm certainly there at your service. Well, here was arguably the best narrator. Richard Burton had not yet come along. He was the unrivaled best narrator. But I was working with a friend who insisted that I should narrate this film. And my friend was right, because what made the film personal and successful was that I was off camera telling the story. So I had to reject Orson's very generous offer. But when I presented him the Life Achievement Award, I remember saying, the last line was, "A great man reminds us of no others."
What a wonderful line. A great man reminds us of no others. They're so individual, and all of those names that you gave earlier, you know, James Cagney and Frank Capra. It feels a little bit, you know, it feels like that enshrined a sort of golden age of Hollywood.
I think it did. Yes. Yeah. And it turned out to be wonderful to be able to write about all these people in this book, because I kind of had these memories and I had the scripts and I had a lot of material to work with, and to bring them to life in a new way in various chapters inspired me that this book might prove very interesting to readers.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the other thing is you have a really unique angle. So you do see the humane side, the humanity of these people, in that, you know, yeah, Carrie is a little bit, there's a little bit of the diva there. And, you know, Orson is a little bit, you know, he wants his money. He wants to raise money to make another film. So that's in the forefront of his mind.
Right. And Jimmy Cagney, when we had dinner before he received his Life Achievement Award, he was just, and his wife, Billy, and he was just so charming, a small dinner. And then he talked to me briefly about the show that was about to happen. And he said, well, I'm going to need a Getavasia. And I said, a Getavasia? And he kind of did a little step. He says, yeah. He said, that's the step we've had billions do when we go off the stage so people will remember us. You just have these wonderful things. And I titled the last chapter of my book, Getavasia, out of respect for Jimmy Cagney, when I came to say, I've got to write a last chapter here. And I thought back to Jimmy.
Yeah, that's a brilliant sort of, it's going back to the old theater world of your family, of sort of like, it's important to make a good entrance, but it's also really important to make a good exit.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And when you came to the later part of your career and you end up producing films and directing a film and you get involved with The Thin Red Line, which feels like you're coming full circle as well to some degree.
Yeah, I frustration. I had 4 years in the government at the USIA under President Kennedy and then partly under Johnson with Ed Murrow. Then it was 12 years to get the AFI started. I thought it would be much briefer than that. Mm. And while I was at AFI, I kind of comforted myself by starting the Life Achievement Award, which I was writing and producing those shows every year, which kept my creative hand in. But basically, I had stepped away from filmmaking. And so that was in 1980. I went back to do that, and I was able to do many things that were important to me, and and to work with Sidney Poitier and Jack Lemmon. These happened to be television miniseries, but they were themes that were very important to me.
And having that creativity, as you say, I mean, it also means that you're sort of going into the 80s and 90s. You're you know, again, directly involved in Hollywood in a way which is more similar to how your father was working.
Yeah, and I started the Kennedy Center Honors and produced it for 37 years, which became the most, I think, respected kind of variety show in the United States. It's not seen overseas, so many of your audience may not know it, but it was constantly being awarded the Emmy for the outstanding show of that sort, and working with all the great artists from theater and ballet, and again this wonderful, you know, life for some of us, maybe everyone, depends on the associations you have. And again, for me now to be working with Leonard Bernstein and Isaac Stern and Agnes DeMille and Jesse Norman and, you know, all of the great Jerome Robbins, you know, it just added such a dimension to my life. You know, you are, I know, interested in writing with your excellent podcast. And I was thinking about it. I mean, I wrote separate prequel, the film with Sidney Poitier, co-wrote, and I wrote or co-wrote all the specials I did. But it also reminded me that writing, I realized how important writing was to my life. You had to write the American Film Institute, you know, and it's writing as persuasion, writing as formulating things, you know, writing to persuade a studio to make a film, writing to make the National Endowment give you more money. And I just realized that how central writing is to my life and to many people's lives, not just for the things that you're credited with on the screen. And then late in life, I decided to write a play. And I'd never written a play, and soon it was on Broadway, you know, so just the, it's so fundamental to making your way in the world. And I've encouraged my children and now my grandchildren, you know, to be able to write, the ability to write a good letter, so valuable, in so many aspects of your life. So I really encourage writing.
Yeah, it's that ability to put language out there and to sort of get a grip of it, get a control of it. That is fascinating. It also reminds me of sort of like you as a teenager sort of reading through all these novels as well to find a film in them, and then you know, later in life you're there reinventing yourself as a playwright, but in the end it's about language and being able to see through language to something else, to something that may be visual or film or maybe on stage as a performance.
Right. And it's storytelling, you know. Even if you're trying to persuade the National Endowment for the Arts to give you $2 million, you have to tell them a story.
Yes, a really good one.
and if you're in trouble with the law, you want to write a good letter to the judge, a good story to make your case.
Absolutely.
Or fortunately, I haven't had to do a great deal of that. The latter.
That was my next question. And so, I mean, when you finally sort of came to sit down and write your memoir, which obviously is a sort of, had you already written stuff in preparation? Was the stuff that you'd been using, you know, through the years, or was this like, right, I'm going to start from scratch and go all the way through?
I had made notes, and around 2000, a wonderful writer friend you may know of, Tim Willicks, a novelist, and who became a friend, an Englishman, we exchanging letters, and I said, what am I going to do with the rest of my life, kind of thing. And he wrote back this eloquent letter about, he thought I had lived a life that would be interesting to others. And he quoted all sorts of wonderful books. And at that time, I then started making a bunch of notes. So I had a lot to go on.
And were there any parts that when you were writing, you thought this is the most sort of difficult parts that were difficult to reconstruct or difficult even from an emotional point of view to go back to?
I don't think of any really. You know, all of it was a challenge. And again, my technique with writing, again, learned from my father. We had a premiere in Hollywood of a restoration of Giant. We did a 4K restoration, which makes it more beautiful than ever, overcoming some of the faults of dissolves that were too technical. But Steven Spielberg had suggested it. And Steven and I introduced the film at Grauman's Chinese just last week, and to see that 65-year-old film with with an audience was really thrilling at the same theater where it had premiered 65 years earlier. And now I forget why I brought up Giant. It was to make a point that I
was asking about any moment that was like a challenge or was difficult in writing the memoir.
Oh, and a story that I told with Stephen to the audience that night is that I was young and I'd come back from the Air Force and I was in the editing room with my father. And Giant ran 3 hours and 20 minutes and had been longer. And I'd been with him, just seeing him refine it and improve it. But he kept working at it. And at one time I said, Dad, I said, this is awfully good film. Why don't you just put it out there? And he said, think of the man hours that are going to be spent looking at this film over the years. Don't you think it's more valuable that I spend some of my time now making it a better film for all those people who are going to spend that time? And it was just his practice of just making it right. And in a minor chord, that's what I really worked at in this book, just to kind of get rid of the stuff and really to try and refine it to make it as good a book as it could be.
It feels like you've learned so much from your father and from so many people through your life. As I was reading it, I was thinking there are lessons here all the way along. I felt like I was learning as well.
Oh, nice. Thank you. Yeah. I was just going to say, John F. Kennedy, that I had this, I had just, I think, two meetings with him and several phone calls, but I was working for him. And when I came time to present this idea at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, which was his memorial, of honoring the great artists in America, I went to the head of the Kennedy Center with one line. I said, it's carved in the walls of marble on this building, the words of John Kennedy. I look forward to an America that won't be afraid of grace and beauty. I look forward to an America that will honor achievement in the arts the way we honor achievement in business or statecraft. And there you had a sentence from a president, which was an idea for an enduring event and television show. And so you have these influences that are so powerful. And he was a great influence on me, his decisiveness, his sense of purpose.
It also makes me long for a time when we had that sort of eloquence in public life.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, we'll get there again. We'll get there again.
let's hope so. Yes, we're all working toward it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, listen, George, you've been absolutely so generous with your time. There's one final question, actually, I'd like to ask you, if at all possible.
Yes.
Because this is a Writers on Film and we always ask for a recommended book, and I know I haven't sort of prepared you for this, but is there a book on cinema that you sort of, or even a memoir or a biography that you sort of consider that you would, it doesn't have to be the best or anything like that, but just that might be interesting to our listeners?
Well, I haven't thought about it, John, but I would put Kevin Brownlow's The Parade's Gone By and Kevin Brownlow's David Lean would be two good thoughts.
Excellent. What brilliant recommendations. And that's a brilliant recommendation for me, because I love David Lean. He's another magnificent director.
Yeah, oh, yes. And I write about David, too. He was such an extraordinary man. And, you know, I have a big television across the way. And even on that screen, instead of the big screen, when Lawrence of Arabia comes on, you know, it's just breathtaking how beautifully rendered and with such imagination and boldness that film is created. And it, you know, I have respect for many of the filmmakers working today. I don't want to be totally a golden age geek. But
who would you look at today? Looking at cinema today, what sort of gives you what filmmakers do you look at and think, oh, they're carrying on the legacy, they're carrying on the stuff?
Oh, Guillermo del Toro, Christopher Nolan, Jane Campion, Paul Thomas Anderson. I think that's really interesting work. Barry Jenkins. Gosh, there's so many, and it's so international. I worry that the resources, you know, the people I've spoken of, David Lean, George Stevens, William Wyler, Fred Zinnemann, they earned their way to having the most resources for making films. Today, the greater amount of resources are going to Marvel Comics and franchise movies with the studios and the streaming people depend on. I wish that there were a more balanced allocation. I wish so many of the films made by the, what I would consider the most more thoughtful directors, or their more thoughtful films, are done almost as B movies. They don't get the big investment, but they get stars to come in for less money. And, you know, I wish they were working with a fairer share of the resources for making movies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally agree with that. Thank you so much for talking to me, George. I really, really appreciate it. And that's wonderful.
Well, John, I just so, and I appreciate your having read the book and talking about it in such interesting ways. And I live in Washington, D.C. I went to Hollywood for the first time in 2 years, which I've always been going back and forth because of COVID. And it was COVID that gave me, forced me to sit down and finish this book. But I hope somewhere along the line we will meet. I hope you continue this and your other good work.
So that was my conversation with George Stevens Jr., and I think you'll agree it was one of the best episodes we've ever had. It's certainly the guest who has had the most first-hand knowledge of the development of Hollywood in the last 60, 70, 80 years. It's when I started this podcast, it was a little over a year ago, and I only intended really to do 10 episodes, partly as well to promote writers that I knew whose books had just been released, partly because I just wanted to have conversations with people who had expert knowledge in the field that I love, and I wanted to learn something. It has become something of a film course for me. I've learned a lot. I've read a lot about a lot of characters that I would not necessarily have pursued on my own, and I'm absolutely glad I did. It's broadened my horizons in a way that I have found extremely enriching, and also in terms of course, my watching of movies. I've been watching films with a much broader perspective than before, and so this has been intensely valuable for me. What I mean by all this is to say that George Stevens Jr. coming on the podcast and talking so beautifully and so interestingly about all these things, it really is a huge endorsement for what we've been doing with Writers on Film, and I'm so proud that this has happened and that this conversation exists and is out there along with all the others. There's a real body of work building up, and it's all because of you, listener, because if I was doing this and I didn't see the numbers, I would not be continuing, believe you me. So, or maybe I would be. I mean, these conversations, even if I didn't publish them, I enjoy having them so much that that I'd probably do it anyway. Okay, that's all from me for today. I'm very sorry, I've got a really bad cough at the moment. not COVID related, I'm glad to say. Another thing I should share with you is when we were doing the podcast, when I was doing the podcast with George and I was talking to him via Zoom, the Wi-Fi kept cutting out, the internet kept dropping, and I would freeze, and it was all on my side. He was fine. It literally happened 4 or 5 times. Hopefully you didn't notice during the episode because I edited it together with such finesse. But I obviously was apologizing profusely. And George, brilliant guy that he is, said, "Oh, all my life it's been technical glitches. Don't worry about it." That's the perspective you have to have. You don't think you put up the AFI without a couple of technical glitches along the way. You don't think you direct films and put plays on Broadway without a couple of technical glitches here and there. So that was incredibly encouraging, and it was so nice because, you know, somebody could quite rightly become impatient at my obvious and evident incompetence, and George didn't, and you know, oh, good stuff. Good luck to him. By the way, George is also our second guest so far to have met John F. Kennedy. The first one was Joseph McBride, if you remember, a few episodes back. Okay, that's enough chatter and blarney from myself. So I will thank Elliot Atkins for his wonderful music. I will thank Ali Harwood for his artwork. And I will thank you, listener. Please tune in next week for another episode.